2024, as far as the big change, we have to be better at what we're doing. We have to be better than we have in order to get an effect change.
I'm Flint Anderson, founder of PAIN, Parents and Addicts in Need. I've been in recovery since 2001, and there isn't much I don't know about recovery. And my mission is to constantly tell the truth about addiction, to make the realities of addiction, recovery, and drug culture known, and to drive awareness and advocate change that ultimately saves lives.
And I'm Jason LaChance, a certified recovery coach with a passion for speaking with others and sharing their knowledge to help others seek recovery and maintain long-term sobriety. And this is the Don't Hide the Scars podcast, presented by PAIN, Parents and Addicts in Need.
Welcome to the Don't Hide the Scars podcast. Riding shotgun today, the founder of Parents and Addicts in Need, Flint Anderson, and myself, Jason LaChance. Mr. Anderson, we are at our year's end, 52 original episodes.
Yeah, nice. 52, yeah. Man, it's gone quick.
Yeah, and it's been an awesome year, and thank you to you, the listener. We know that's because you guys are getting value out of the podcast, sharing with other people, subscribing to the YouTube channel. If you haven't yet, hey, please go to the YouTube channel, which the link is in the podcast description. Hit that subscribe button, hit likes, thumbs up, leave comments, and of course, ring that bell so you know when we put out new content here from Parents and Addicts in Need. This episode, though, Flint, we are going to revisit some of the most listened to / watched episodes of 2023 because there was so many amazing guests this year.
Yeah, there really was. I was really, really impressed with the guests that we had, the content that was discussed, and the passion with which they did it. That just made our year. I mean, it really did. And, you know, of course, our listening base went up and, you know, because of these guests, and gosh, we just can't thank them enough.
Absolutely. Well, one that we really had a great time talking with, we actually split his conversation into two episodes. We're pulling just a couple of different key points here from Dan Carity, of course, one of the original judges of So You Think You Could Dance. Really confronted his alcoholism, and through it, he's wanted to dig more into addiction recovery, and how to be of service. So we had an amazing conversation. We touched on not only understanding the addict, which was really his inquiry with us, primarily you, and we also talked the aftermath of inpatient treatment and that process of coming home, which I kind of sat back and enjoyed you and Dan talk about, you know, the very similar experiences of coming home to the missus and the kids and the way that life changes. So here's two awesome segments of our conversation with Dan.
At the time they want help, they're sincere about it. But as we all know, you know, the recovery piece takes 2 to 4 years for normalcy to somewhat return, for the brain to heal, for everybody to get back on that same page. But when you've got that kind of money, you can go to a rehab 5 times a year.
Yeah.
You know, there's always an out. There's always an out for people with that kind of money. And I think, and you are absolutely right, when these celebrities are surrounded by people that depend on that person for their income, right? They're not going to give them the straight scoop on all of this stuff. Because the first thing that I would do is I would walk in there and say, okay, it's you and me. There's nobody else here. Period. And if you want what I've got, you're going to listen to me. If you don't want what I have, then go about your business and actually don't waste my time.
Yeah.
And until somebody can do that, I think this is, they're just on a merry-go-round.
Yeah. No, I agree. You know, I was fortunate enough. I mean, I don't put myself in the same position as those people, but like I was fortunate enough. My wife clearly had enough of me. And was eager to get me into rehab. But when the one person I had to call, who I consider my best friend, but he's also my manager, his name is Michael. And he's like my manager, my agent, my lawyer, he does everything for me, but he's my best friend as well. And I was fortunate enough that his only concern was that I get healthy, was that I get right. And he was like, I don't care how long it takes, you go, I'll handle everything on the business end of things. Yeah. And call me when you need me. He didn't care how many shows I was going to miss, how much work I was going to miss, you know, how many dollars he would be missing out of his bank account right. because of that. That wasn't his concern. He cared about me. And and actually, like, I joke, but it's there's a level of truth to it. He cares about my kids, I think, more than he does about me. Right? So, so he wanted me to get right for my family, you know, and thank God for that. But, you know, when you do talk about the celebrities, I mean, there's the other stories like the Justin Biebers of the world, who we all know was going down a horrible path.
Right.
And his mom and his manager came together. They yanked him off tour. They cost themselves tens of millions of dollars.
Right.
But they saw what was happening to them. And they're like, we need to save him. Mm-hmm. And they did everything they could. And it cost all of them money. But they were okay with that because they were concerned with his well-being, not with how much money they could make off him. And thank God, because, I mean, I don't know him personally. I don't know how he's doing right now. But by all appearances, he's in a way better place, you know, than he was two, three years ago.
The other fallacy is a lot of people think that just because you walk into a rehab for 30 days, that everything's going to be fine when you come out of there. And we all know that's just the beginning of this mess.
Yeah.
Right. So what we try to do here is we really try to get that message across to, and I'm just not talking about mom and dad. I'm talking about aunts and uncles and grandparents and cousins and friends and all of them, because if everybody's not on the same page with this thing, they're going to be back through my door in a matter of a few months.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, to follow up on that, it's my wife, I feel like, has put in just as much work, if not more, than I have on this whole thing.
Yeah.
Because she admittedly doesn't get it.
Right.
She doesn't get it at all. And so she's trying so hard to educate herself every step of the way. And she's finding different counselors and therapists for herself to meet with, plus the Al-Anon and everything. And God forbid I go too many days without saying something to her. You know, she does not let it go. You know, she's checking in with me or whatever, because she knows not to let me go too long without talking about something or expressing how I feel or something about our relationship. And, you know, to your point, it's like everyone has to be invested in your recovery, everyone you're surrounded with, because they all make a difference for you. And for them to be able to see signs, you know, ways you're acting, things you say, places you go, they need to know what's going on.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's insightful how Dan shared that his best friend, who's also his manager, really, you know, cleared his schedule, so to speak, which doesn't always happen for someone in a celebrity role, to get him in treatment. And as he said, I think he cared more about my kids than me, which is totally fine.
At that point, somebody probably needed to be cared more for his kids than he did, you know?
Right, right. Yep. Well, and I understand that. Yes, me too. That is very familiar to me, that thought, feeling, emotion of processing that and confronting my own addiction issues and realizing, I need to do the work, not just so my kids hopefully have a wonderful life or at least a path of less inflicted trauma, so to speak, but that I could be a present father and enjoy that for the time that I'm granted. So it's, that was a really insightful segment.
Yeah, it was.
And then, you know, we included in there too that the importance of the aftercare process. You know, the 12 steps is important, but there's so much more to it. And it's wonderful to get that kind of insight from you.
Yeah. You know, the aftercare piece, again, is, you know, I have to say it is more important than the actual 30-day stay. Because, again, if people just treat that as getting them off the drugs, that's in my opinion, that's the key, obviously, because you can't do outpatient without getting off the substance first. I just don't understand people that want to keep, you know, just put somebody right into outpatient program. Right. It doesn't work that way. But yeah, the importance of that was something, and Dan agreed with it as well, that I just wish more people would do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, and a big part of that process can be the intervention process, too, that can play such a key role in not only saving someone's life, but helping them actually have a life. And so we got a renowned interventionist, just simply because we've never talked to another intervention person that does interventions. And I wanted to see, you know, really you two collaborate, the awesome Mike Diamond.
He's the best.
Yeah. We talked about misunderstandings about interventions and also how the aftermath of the changing dynamic within the family that occurs too, and the family's part of the process, not only with the intervention, but recovery.
Yeah. You know, first of all, I have nothing but respect for Mike and what he does and the interventions that he's involved in. And it was really interesting because both Mike and I kind of tackled interventions, you know, in the same fashion. Mm. We obviously do our homework beforehand. And like, you know, I mentioned to him, it's like, I just want to get in and get it done. You know, let's get in there. Let's don't sit around and kumbaya this thing to death, because that's all a part of it. Every addict that's having the intervention done on them, they already know the family loves them, you know, so let's bypass all that kind of nonsense and let's get to the meat of the real meat of it and get them out of there and in some place as quickly as possible.
Absolutely. Well, and he really spoke to, and I know I've had conversations with you about that importance of breaking through with the addict and connecting with him. So this is one of the highlight clips. And we also include in here that changing of dynamic when that individual gets sober. So here was some highlights from Mike Diamond.
I got full confidence that God's going to lead me through this thing and direct me through it. And guess what? Every single time he's done it. So there it is. That's that. Now, people may disagree, but again, I don't care.
No, you know what I love about that as well? Like, what I always say is that I'll do the preparations, and if it's letters, it's letters, whatever. And then I just surrender.
Yeah.
I don't know. And I just go, I don't know. And I let my intuition guide me, because I've had interventions where there was one where it was a woman and she didn't want to go. And someone else was running the intervention. And I just kicked everyone out of the room. And I just said, let me have coffee with her in a kitchen. And I just sat her down and I said, hey, look, I don't know if you're an addict. I just walked into this. But I know you hate your husband, right? Because she was like mouthing off at her husband. I said, but you got two daughters that love you, right? She goes, yeah. And I said, why don't we do this? Why don't you just go, right? Your daughters love you. I'll go with you. I'll get you into treatment. And we go from there. Yeah. I don't know if you're an alcoholic, but let's just do it for your daughters. She's like, I'll go. Got her on the plane, got her in there. And it was totally unscripted, and she went. Another guy was smoking crack. Every bottom line, didn't want to go. I said, let's just have lunch. And we're having lunch. And he's half Greek. I'm half Greek. We're starting talking. I was in the clove business as a kid. He was in the clove business. I said, look, I'll ask you one question. He said, what? I'm like, it's just one question. Just answer the question honestly, and you'll make the decision. He said, what? I said, are you happy? He said, I'm not. I'm miserable. I said, okay, let's work from there. Let's just get you happy. I know if you get sober, we can start straight into treatment.
Right.
And it was like everything, because it's like if I'm having a conversation with you as a real human, and I'm spending time to study people and I've done a little work, I'm going to just feel you. And if I don't, you don't feel me, you're going to go, fuck this guy.
Right. And by the way, I've had people go, fuck this guy.
Right.
Okay.
And you're like, okay, I was that guy.
Yeah. Right.
So it's like that, like you said, it's that perfect, it's finding, and no one can teach it. It's at a perfect, like, you know it, like I know it, like, it's like all the work you can do, right? But at the end of the day, when you're on the free throw line, you've got to be able to know how to throw that free throw.
Yeah.
And that's what people can't train. It's like it's got to be in you to like people and to know people and to feel them and to want to be near them and to want to see them do good. And that resonates, because the addict that breaks into the subconscious mind, the addict goes, yeah, this person actually, he's here for me.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's where everyone gets it. you get it, Flint. There's all these people out there doing interventions. Like, you shouldn't be doing interventions. You're not doing an intervention to help the review. You're just fucking trying to make money. You know what's really interesting? I say, Senator, like, I know people to this day that still won't accept the fact that they're addicts or just the behavior. Do you know what I mean? The family, the dysfunction, the just the co-signing of just the bad behavior, codependency. But if you really, like, if you really break it down and you go, okay, this person is making really bad choices, and you cut out, you cut them out. You say, look, we're not going to support these choices. Right. Very few people are going to really, it sucks. Like, there is people, of course, that are homeless and they've got mental health issues. But most people, if they've come from something that's codependent, if they hit the skids, they'll turn it around pretty quick. Like you said, like, they hit, I've had people, I'm like, leave them in jail for a week. What do you mean? Like, they think they're a tough guy, leave them in jail for a week, see what happens. And then they get around some real criminals, like some real hardened criminals. They're like, this is this is a little different. This isn't the movies. Like, do you know what I mean? And they start to sober up and really sober up. And they're like, oh, wow, like, I've got no lifeline. But it's incredible. What sucks to me is people's fear of, because their own sickness, it's better the devil you know. Mm-hmm. Instead of just going, no, this, you got to cut them off. You got to, someone, there's got to, you've allowed this to happen. Now you have to draw the line. And most people won't do it. They just won't. They won't. Don't have the ability. Nope. And it's bad.
That was so great to talk with Mike and be a part of that conversation, because it opened my eyes so much to intervention. And I guess I should have prefaced it to the thing that really made me want to have that conversation was somebody asked, hey, do you do interventions? And my response was, that would be extremely irresponsible of me. No, I've never done an intervention. Right. I vaguely recollect my father's intervention. I believe I was there. You know, so I think so many people, think that they can do the intervention process, and it's so irresponsible if you don't know what you're doing.
Right. And again, I will continue to say this all along. For somebody to do an intervention that's not in recovery, that doesn't understand the addict themselves, get out of the way. Mm-hmm. Because you truly are, that person is doing more damage than good at that point. And the addict knows. Addicts aren't stupid people.
No.
We know who we can BS and who we can't. And man, when some, you know, if we've got a non-addict trying to convince my butt to go to treatment, man, I got you. All right. I got you. I'm going to run all over you. And that's, again, that's what I love about Mike. And, you know, because we're both in recovery and that's a key part of it. It really is.
And well, and really studied different processes and methods for
There are different methods.
Sure. Yeah.
There are definitely different methods. You know, there's people that don't necessarily do what I do. I don't do what necessarily they do. Mm-hmm. And it's okay because, but as long as one doing the intervention understands the addict, I don't care how you do it. I don't care how you do it. Let's get them in the car. Let's get them on the plane. Let's get them on the train. Let's do whatever, but let's get them somewhere.
Absolutely.
You bet.
It was really fascinating to have all three of us converse about that changing family dynamic and how the family plays a role in it too, you know, because I noticed when I got sober for the better with at least my core family, the relationships really changed, but there was some of the, you know, what do we call it? Extended family it was like, that person's not really going to be a part of my life anymore because now I had the ability to define who I didn't want access to me, boundaries, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, I just had to.
Right. Yeah. It, look, the whole family dynamic is obviously critical in this. And a lot of times, I mean, you know, again, here at Payne, we, you know, that's one thing we focus on is that care, that help for the family when their addict loved one is in treatment and after treatment. We want that family to continue, and we certainly hope that they do. The problem in today's society, though, is a lot of families don't. You know, they really think that once, especially if this is somebody's first go around, they think that the addict's got it made. They've got it made. They come home clean and sober. Everything's fine. The world's roses. And it's just the opposite. So, yeah. But again, our focus here is to make sure that those families continue to get that right. counseling and that help that they need to get through this.
Absolutely. And don't forget that we do have the support group meeting on Wednesday nights. That link is in the podcast description, 6:30 Pacific Standard Time. So we do give a Zoom option you can join. And of course, in person as well. Here at Payne.
New Perceptions North, the premier drug and alcohol treatment and recovery center in Central California. A full continuum of medically supervised top quality care with programs for detox and patient residential treatment with dual diagnosis, intensive outpatient treatment, sober living support groups, and more. New Perceptions North provides adult men and women with the highest caliber of professional health care, treating each client with compassion and respect. In a safe, comfortable environment to begin the process of recovery to proudly create and sustain a life without addiction. Call 559-978-1507 or visit newperceptionsnorth.com.
And it's really interesting to talk about that aftermath of recovery, because so many people, obviously the family thinks, you did your 30 days, it's done, here we go. And sometimes addicts, we can look at it that way, too.
You bet.
And I know my first year, there was a lot of ignorance to what I was going to be faced with come, year two and going into, more long-term sobriety. And we really got into that with Mark Gant, who happened to be our highest listened to episode of the year. We previously had his wife on, Brianna Davis, who is in recovery for sex and love addiction. So we dug in with Mark in a really interesting way that he got sober really young.
Yeah, he did.
And he did. That seemed to really resonate with a lot of people. They got a lot of value out of it. It seemed that that was a big share episode, hopefully showing, hey, young
it
man
can be
or
done.
Woman, it can be done.
Yeah, exactly.
But 20 years after the substances were out of his life, he's done that work. He had to confront the issue with money addiction and entered Debtors Anonymous. So it's so insightful to see that, hey, yeah, I did all this, but guess what? I found I had a whole nother issue. And that's how these things can spike up at any time.
They can. And, Mark's a great guy. And and to get sober at such a young age is remarkable in itself. And look, not everybody and I want to make sure that the younger listeners know this and younger people know this. That happened to Mark. Things happen to all of us. We can and sometimes do discover that we've got something extra in the tank that we've got to deal with. But a lot of times that's not the case. I know plenty of individuals that have gotten sober at a relatively young age and have maintained the rest of their lives, so to speak, I don't want people just to automatically think that there's something else around the corner, because again, it's just not always true. But once you're in recovery, I think it's kind of easy to recognize those faults that we have because we're learning about ourselves from the time we get clean till forever. Yeah. So if somebody does have an issue, whether it's sex, love, whether it's gambling, whether it's whatever the case may be, you know what? At least we've got some tools in our belt now that we're able to go to work on that as well.
Yeah, because the work in those areas, same principles.
Same principles, you bet.
Same principles. So two really great clips here with Mark. Not only is he talking about that point of acknowledgement, being 20 years sober and hearing the first time Debtors Anonymous and getting a conversation with the individual who's already in it, but also how the dynamic of his wife's sex and love addiction issues really played into his well, really his money troubles and where he was doing a lot of buy, cover, sell, you know. He talks about selling or his biggest project where it was generating millions of dollars, and he goes to check his bank account and he's got like 12 cents in savings, you know, and it's just like, it's crazy. So some real insightful stuff here with Mark Gant.
What for you, maybe the people don't understand about going down that debtors anonymous route that helped you, just what was your clarity moment? Like, oh my gosh, this is a major problem and I need help.
Yeah. You know, so it's, you know, I was very fortunate. I got sober at 19. So, you know, I had, you know, a good about 6 years of like partying and, you know, screwing on my life and wrecking cars and, you know, putting the people and, you know, that around me in danger and, you know, stuff. And so I was fortunate to get sober early. And, you know, I worked a program, I went to AA, and I changed my life. I got the cash and prizes, you know, things were good. I was about 20 years sober. And the one thing that just like was, oh, I mean, now I look at now I can go back and go, there's a lot more than just one thing. But at the time, I felt the one thing that was still problematic for me was finances. Like I didn't understand, you know, I worked really hard, you know, and I played hard. I'd spend, you know, if I made money, I would spend the money. And sort of the having this sort of inconsistent relationship with money. Like there was a time where like when money was coming, it was like, yes, this is how it's going to be. It's going to just this trajectory, this thing is going to go this way. And then it wouldn't. And then I was like, I don't understand why. Okay, I just need to work harder. Maybe I need to work harder, make more money. And, you know, really, it was this thing that just kept going. It was like, it's just a cycle that would happen. Like I would make some money, I'd feel good. And then for some reason I would find myself back to zero again. Right. And this, the final time, you know, was, at the highest of my high. Like I had just like the, you know, I had sold this show to a studio. I was, you know, winning awards. I had this beautiful girlfriend who's now my wife, and my life was fantastic. There's really nothing that I could see that was wrong on the outside, except inside. Like inside, right, there still was this hole, you know, like I had 20 years sober, but I wasn't actually having emotional sobriety. I wasn't actually in, you know, I wasn't in a place where I had a relationship with a higher power and that I was, you know, working a program to the degree that I needed to. And so the money thing was one of the things that stood out. And I was in a meeting of AA, and, you know, the speaker was talking, and she just all sort of her journey and where it was more what it was like now kind of thing. And sort of her career change and, you know, things, there was a lot of money stuff talking, you know, that she was talking about, like stability and things like that. And at the end, you know, she was, you know, said, thank you. I just shout out to, you know, Debtors Anonymous, which, you know, that was, you know, another program that saved my life. Okay. Thank you. You know? And I was like, what? Debtors, what's that? What's that? 20 years sober, never heard of Debtors Anonymous. What's that? I've never heard of that. And so we walked outside and talked to her, and she told me about a meeting, and I went to the meeting. I was like, started listening to what I was hearing. And there were a lot of common themes and things that I was hearing that were very similar to mine. And it's a similar, you know, as to any addiction, that it's sort of affecting, you know, my self-worth, my value, you know, how I, carry myself in the world, where I think, you know, sort of my value is. And, you know, the big part of it became about sort of this, you know, another way for me to escape how I'm feeling, you know,
right.
You know, the way I was, you know, sort of the environment, you know, at a young age with divorce and separation and, you know, different, you know, things that were going on, that was just, I wanted to escape. So that escape, you know, worked early on, from stealing to video games, yep, to TV, to movies, to, you know, to, you know, wanting, you know, to have a fantasy that if I had all this stuff, things would be, I would be okay. You know, right. If I had achieved these things, this would be, I would be okay and loved and everything. And so I think that at the bottom, I could say that for my drinking, all those actions, you know, those that as the, my alcoholism, the same sort of thing, all those things, you know, to avoid the way I'm feeling, you know, hopefully something on the outside will fix that, you know.
Mark Gant, what a good guy.
Great guy.
Yeah, just really appreciate him getting the time in and really continuing to be of service and being so vulnerable, you know, so far into addiction or recovery, excuse me, that I think at times, you know, we can close up a little bit. You know, I know I've had moments.
Sure. I mean, I've, you know, there's been times in my recovery where, yeah, I've closed up, closed down, shut down, you know, whatever it is, but not for too long a period of time. You know, I look again, people that are not in recovery have to understand that people in recovery are just as human as everybody else, you know, and we are going to have those moments where we're not always just smiling and sunshine because we're clean and sober. No, because now we realize that life has hit us right between the teeth and, you know, and there's some issues that we're still going to have to deal with, you know, so it's we're like everybody else.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, our another guest that we had on here from the sunshine state of Florida, Ali Severino, just an amazing lady. I mean, doing so much work within the community and just she has such an interesting backstory and really breaking that generational addiction that ran in her family. And there was so much we could have talked to her about, but also her working in and around treatment. We really want to talk about the hindrance of insurance on getting people help, evolving treatment protocols, because the illicit drug supply has evolved so much, not only into fentanyl, but trank and you know all these other things that are entering it, as well as the hard challenge of people that are on the front line and combating the harm reduction people, especially when it prevents someone really in need of treatment from ever even opening their mind to that's where life should go.
Right. I just love Ali. She's me in a skirt.
And well, you both do have nice eyes.
Yeah, well, thank you. And she is an amazing woman. And I'll tell you what, she went through it. Mm. You know, she went through it, and I give her a lot of credit. She is. She's you know, she's making a statement. She's helping people. She's just out there in the middle of it. And that's what I really like, you know? But yeah, she's, God, I wish she lived in California, to be honest with you, but right. You know, maybe one day we'll get her out here.
Yeah. And, here's some segments that we pulled from the conversation. Cause Ali, you know, you had questioned her about what she was seeing in the illicit supply. She brought up everything from seeing a respike in bath salts and starting to see what, you know, we primarily saw in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia area, you know, the trank and stuff like that, but a bit of a trickle of that into the supply there in Florida. And she speaks on the protocols and how there's so many challenges, including insurance and so forth, on changing any of these protocols and how treatment centers can really have their hands tied. Plus, we dig into the supporting the homeless, not in getting treatment or help, but their addiction and how having to combat that daily makes it so hard for those of us that are just really trying to help someone actually get recovery.
Right. It just, it believe it or not, people like us that are trying to help others, our hands get tied more than not, you know, in this. And again, until the system changes, you know, we just have to keep fighting through it and do the best we can. But like I said, she's doing a great job. And I'll tell you what, I wouldn't want to get in Ali's way.
No, absolutely not. But here's those highlights from Ali Severino.
So my point is this: if there's a 60-year-old and above that lives in, again, what we call the 2-block area, right? And they're just kind of living, right? Then I don't care if they're on methadone, because it's going to, if it keeps them off the needle, keeps them off fentanyl, absolutely. But why are we going to keep the 25-year-old on it and strapped to it for which could be the rest of their life?
Yeah.
By the way, whenever you get time, I don't need to mention it here, but whenever you get time, look at the long-term health effects of methadone on somebody. It's all the way from heart disease to bowel obstructions to sleep patterns being destroyed, all of it. And a lot of that is with Suboxone as well. My thing is just this, and then I'll shut up. Okay. It's being properly educated so people can make the correct choice on it. I'm not here to tell somebody what to do. I'm here to tell somebody this is what's going to happen to you if you decide to go down this road, or this road.
Mm-hmm.
Now you make the call.
Right.
And that's,
I have to give you a little pushback, Flint.
Absolutely. Push me back.
I love this. This is so fun. We got to do this all the time.
Okay.
On the test strips, though. Now, for kids, giving kids test strips, I don't know about all that. But I did read a lot of studies that show, like, these large music festivals. When these large music festivals offer individuals the ability to test their drugs, they often do. When the drugs come back something different than they think they are, they often do not use them. And there was a large music festival in England or whatever, where they saw a 95% decrease in hospitalizations due to drugs because of them offering testing. So while, yes, I think it could give some people the idea of, well, you know, they give us a test strip to test it, so we... And it's kind of opening that door to make it okay to use. I think it can be made safer. Also, we had two people overdose after in their honeymoon in their bed because they thought they were doing Molly and it wasn't Molly. What was it? Fentanyl, right? Mm-hmm. And they died. So for recreational drug users, I think it could be a positive thing. Also, the state of Ohio had more overdoses from fentanyl-laced cocaine than fentanyl-laced heroin. And so I know that there's people who do drugs recreationally who are not drug addicts. And I don't believe that someone should have to die because they went to, what was the big club back in the day in New York City?
Studio 54. I was there.
Imagine going to Studio 54 just to have some fun and you do a little blow and you're dead. Like, I had a person smoking crack overdose a couple weeks ago. Not normal. This is not what drugs have always been. And because of that, you know, I am. But I do agree kind of with the needle exchanges. I'm not a big fan of.
Yeah. Well, just to let you know, when I was at Studio 54, I was there. Okay. In 1979, they told me I had a great time.
You had a lot of great time.
I had a lot of great time. Okay. I really did. I really did. Okay. So I love what you said. I truly do, but I'm going to go back again. Not a lot of pushback, just a hair. Okay.
Sure.
DanceSafe.org. Have you heard of them?
Yes,
okay, I'm sure that's the music people you're talking about.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Check them out even more.
Okay.
Check out their website more. Check out the ads they're putting out there. All right. That will say, what was the one? Instead of injecting fentanyl, try snorting it.
Right. Well, no, it was,
you know,
instead of snorting, try smoking.
Yes. That was.
So it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like where the total misguidedly, it just deviates from the good intentions, you know? So
they are a corporation that is making money, that is bringing kids in to dance because that's how they make their living.
Right.
They're going to work this thing as much as possible to make sure kids are still coming through that door. And when you talk about statistics that they saw 95, that's almost like saying, you know what, our treatment center, we have a 99% success rate. which you know is crap. Okay.
Right. It's some crap. Facilities say that, or not 99, but they'll say something close to that.
Exactly. Right. And I know it's crap because we're not.
Admission went good. That's what that means. They admitted successfully.
That's exactly right. Because we're nowhere near that. Right. In fact, it's so hard to keep. You can't even keep a statistic on something like that, because after they leave, where do they go? If you don't, if they're not in your program, who the hell knows? But again, getting back to these guys, 95%, I would have rather them said 60%. And I might have maybe even believed it a little bit, but where do they get their stats?
Right.
Where do they get their stats? The hospitals aren't going to allow them to see those stats.
Right. That's a good point. I will look into it more.
Yeah.
Because you know, something that I have learned also in the past couple of years is advocates often have good intentions, but the things that they advocate for are not always good.
Yeah.
In a simple way. They're not always going to work out the way they think they are. And I've only really learned this from the homelessness crisis. I'm sure you guys are in California. You see it on a larger scale than us, but we're experiencing it big time. But we have a lot of advocates who advocate for these individuals to do drugs outside, live outside, very mentally ill, drug addicted, in their own feces, like it's okay. And I don't agree with that. You know, I don't agree that that's how we should treat our most vulnerable. I don't agree that that's the best method for them to have a happy, healthy life. I don't believe that they even are in control of their life, that like they have any of that self-control that we have to make our decisions every day. But I do see their fight, and it does scare me. Because I see their fight making things so much worse, because it has made it harder for me to get people into treatment. Also, because like you said, while they're outside, they bring them food, Narcan, clean needles, clothing, shower truck, all that stuff to kind of, and it does enable of them to stay outside longer or die there and never make it into recovery.
Talk with Allie. I mean, just we'll have to get her on again. And, you know, I think we could probably pick any topic and go. But it's really insightful to get someone else that has been there like you have and working in treatment and just helping people understand the actual challenges that are really going on here. And you've really cemented it best. There's two kinds of people. Those with insurance or the means to do it, or those without the right kind of insurance or no means. Right. And, you know, there's such a lack, and it's frustrating.
It's extremely frustrating. That's the reality though of treatment today. I wish more people would look at it like that, you know, in those two categories, because it seems like there's always that everybody's lumped into one category. And again, I'm not, this isn't about, you know, disliking one group or the other, or because of the color of your skin, has nothing to do with it, but it does have to do with who's got the insurance and who doesn't, and who's got the means and who doesn't, you know, so there has to become some meeting of the minds here, right? In the correct way to get everybody the same type of help.
Absolutely. Well, and one individual that, boy, we look forward to working with in 2024, the passionate, compassionate, yet calls it like it is, Tom Wolf. Such an extraordinary individual. Such a pleasure that we made his acquaintance.
Yeah.
If you didn't catch Tom's story, make sure that you listen to not only one, but two episodes about the work that he's doing. I mean, you know, we really dug in with him. What is actually going on on the streets of San Francisco? What is harm reduction doing to the addict that just looks like they're never going to get any help at the rate we're going?
Yeah, no, I mean, I have nothing but respect for Tom Wolf, like I do with all of our guests, but Tom Wolf kind of stands in a little corner by himself over here, because again, like a lot of us, he's lived it, he's been through it, he knows, and he's a no bullshit kind of guy, and he's going to say it like it is. And of course, those are the people I like the most. You know, sometimes kind of damn the consequences, but he is he's in the battle.
Mm-hmm.
He's really in the battle and he knows his stuff. It's so nice to talk to somebody that really knows the ins and outs of the city of San Francisco and what's going on in the county, what's going on everywhere in the state of California. He's on top of it, like we're on top of it here. And so it's nice to have that kind of conversation to back up what we're saying and we back up what he's saying. So if other people are listening to this, they're going, oh, okay, well, maybe these guys do know, you know, what's going on. So it's just nice to hear from him. And by the way, again, I think whatever it's 8 years of recovery, whatever it is, man, to get for somebody to have, or it's either 6 or 8, to have that many years of recovery and coming from the fentanyl background,
yep,
off the streets of San Francisco, into a powerful voice, not only in San Francisco, but in Sacramento as well. Man, I give this guy all the credit in the world.
Absolutely. And one of the things I really love about Tom as well is we've joked on the podcast, you know, if you lined us up on the political line, Tom's to the left, I'm in the center, you're to the right. And he doesn't give a shit about that. He
right.
gives a shit about what the right thing to do for human life.
Right.
And he'll call it out like it is. He'll say if it's Democrats, Republicans, doesn't matter who it is, if their policy is BS, he says it.
Yeah, he does. And again, that's what I like about the guy, you know, because again, this should not be a political issue.
Nope.
This should not be left versus right, Democrats versus Republicans. It should not be that way. And again, Tom calls that out. And you know what? And he's actually doing something,
yeah,
you know, about it. But we still have to have more people like him, more people like us that are going to be able to affect change somewhere. Because like we always talk about, Tom knows this, it's not getting any better.
Yeah. Well, and some of the highlights from it, we talk about not only the long-term effects of harm reduction. Tom really talks, he shares a little bit about his process that he did, you know, go on Suboxone, and then it was a wean off process. But I mean, geez, we just did an episode on Matthew Perry's passing, how that played into it.
Right.
And, you know, we're just seeing the effects of a mindset that when it comes to harm reduction, that nobody's really shouting other than yourself and Tom.
Right.
And now I'm in that yep. group of people that there's so much harm here, people that you're not sharing publicly and honestly.
Right. And that, again, that's another thing I like about Tom. He's in a city where it's all about harm reduction and free needles and free this and free foil and drugs and spoons and needles and all the rest of it. But there is that piece to him that likes, like I do, the short-term harm reduction mm-hmm. piece, which is perfectly fine because that's what keeps us alive until we can get that person that help, but only for a short amount of time. And Tom preaching that in San Francisco, man, he's got his hands full.
Absolutely. Well, here's Tom on the effects of long-term harm reduction, what he's actually been seeing over and over, sadly, as well. We do get into safe injection sites, needle exchanges, and even some of the misguided ways there is that it's just not going to work when you keep hours and weekends off.
So yeah.
Here's the highlights from our first conversation with Tom Wolf.
I've seen the long-term effects of people on methadone. You see a lot of people in San Francisco that are hunched over,
yeah,
walking around, like bent over, kind of like the whatever.
Hunchback of Notre Dame,
that guy, right? And, you know, I talked to a bunch of them on the street, and they've all been on methadone for 20 years, 15 yeah. years. And, like, they're you know, they're sober, right? But they're on methadone, and they're all hunched over. And it's like, you know, there's all these side effects that come along with it, stenosis, all these things that people don't know about that you know, give you these long-term effects. And so I generally agree with you. So, and this is the thing about fentanyl that's kind of changed the game. So, you know, if you were a heroin addict, you could go 30 years on heroin and live,
yeah,
right? You could use methadone for 30 years and live, right? You could use Suboxone for 30 years and live. You'd have other health problems, but you'd be alive. But fentanyl, you last in about 2 years once you start using it. And then it's lights out.
Right.
It's really lights out. That's one of the biggest things I try to impress upon elected leaders and local officials, politicians, is that, you know, we've got about a 2-year window for a human being that's addicted to fentanyl, especially if they're on the street, to try to help them. After that, you know, it's probably too late.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and our very own Pam Smith here, who lost her son to an accidental overdose. I mean, how many of this is where it's the kid off at college and he's feeling all the pressure and somebody said, hey, Xanax is a pretty cool thing to take away that anxiety. And they do the order over Snapchat. And what do they get? A pill laced or primarily or totally fentanyl. And they're gone. Mm-hmm. First time.
I'm proud to say that I stand with those parents. I was in Sacramento 2 weeks ago, standing with Matt Capialuto and the drug-induced homicide folks, and they filed a ballot measure to put Alexandra's Law on the ballot.
Sure.
And I was proud to stand with them at their press conference. And I know many of those parents that have struggled with that, the Didiers and Jaime Puerta, and a lot of those parents that have gone through that. And that's one of the most frustrating things to me, is that you've got dealers that are deliberately selling a drug marketed as something else that has fentanyl in it, and people are dying from it, and then nothing happens to that dealer because the war on drugs has failed. Mm-hmm. So, dude, that's at the least, that's manslaughter.
At least.
If not murder. And so, you know, I'm sorry. It's like, you're going to do that kind of crime, you got to do that kind of time. And those guys need to be held accountable, and we need to send a message that this will no longer be tolerated in our community and in the state of California. So I fully support increasing penalties for fentanyl dealers. Again, fentanyl is a completely different beast, and it's completely changed the game.
Yeah, it has. You know, in fact, when we were up there the last time, I've been up there numerous times, and as our own Pam Smith here was telling her story about this, her son, you know, I'm sitting there in the Public Health and Safety Committee, and two things happened. There was Assemblywoman Bonta, who looked over at Pam and said, and I quote, oh, Ms. Smith, we grieve with you, but is it really going to do any good to put that drug dealer in jail? And she might as well have punched Pam right in the teeth. You know, and then Assemblyman, I can't remember if he's from Santa Monica. Anyway, he says, wow, he goes, I just can't believe that every drug dealer is lacing every pill with fentanyl. And I wanted to stand up and say, how stupid are you? You know, are you not even paying attention to anything that is going on here? Look, that is, and then Bonta wanted to turn it into a race issue. And again, what I wanted to say was, okay, Ms. Bonta, you're African-American, you have African-American children. If an African-American drug dealer knowingly sold your child a fentanyl-laced Oxy or a fentanyl-laced Xanax, you wouldn't want that person in prison?
Yeah.
Of course you would.
Yeah, I know. It's foul. I'm sorry, it is. I completely reject that kind of thinking. Look, if you're a bartender in a bar and you started putting cyanide in someone's drinks on purpose, shouldn't that bartender go to prison?
Great analogy.
So what's the difference if the drug dealer knows that the stuff he's selling has fentanyl in it, and then he actually sells it as Xanax? Yeah. Shouldn't he go to prison?
Yeah.
And they're like, does it, you know, look, there's something to be said for victims' rights, and there's something to be said about justice.
Right.
Like, look, I don't care if another dealer replaces that guy. That guy isn't going to be out there selling drugs again to another unsuspecting kid and killing them.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, it's for me, it's a moral issue too.
You bet.
I think it's immoral not to hold those guys accountable. It's like, look, we are a nation of laws. And without those laws, we will fall. We will fall into anarchy. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that we have to be hardcore with everything. If you want to reform the criminal justice system, knock yourself out, but you better actually build the infrastructure first to support those changes before you just go off and start making all these laws that decriminalize everything. Because I'll tell you what, here's an interesting stat that I use, and people don't think about this, but since 2015, the state of California has reduced the prison population by 70,000 people. In that same time, from 2015 to now, the homeless population in California grew by 70,000 people, almost exactly the same number, right? 70,000. Now, I'm not going to sit here and try to prove a causation between the two, but there's absolutely a correlation. Why? Because someone gets out of prison, you release them with $50 and a bus ticket to the county that you were paroled to, and you get there and there's maybe a halfway house where you get to live for 90 days, and then after that, you're on your own. How many of those guys ended up on the street or reoffending, yeah, selling drugs or overdosing, all of those things, right? Because there was no infrastructure to support them, right? So this whole thing to me is kind of hypocritical, and they're just doing it almost like out of guilt rather than actually doing it based in logic. And it's really frustrating.
That's what I say all the time. It's just all this stuff is just masking your BS guilt.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there was something else you said. Oh, you know, when it comes to, we talk about this quite often because we deal with a lot of young people here. And again, we're not dealing with young people that are out on the street. We're dealing with young people that still live with mom and dad. They're still going to school. They're still, you know, they're still being kids, but idiot ones. But you know, what's happening and what we're seeing here is, you know, when I hear the term accidental overdose anymore, Tom, a lot of this is not accidental anymore. But when a parent loses a child, and again, God bless them, I will never put myself in their position. I've spent countless hours with numerous parents that have lost kids to this. They seem to go towards, yes, my son or my daughter died of an accidental overdose, when in fact, a lot of these kids are buying fentanyl intentionally. We have the kids to prove it. We have the kids that say it. We have the kids that are selling it, that are saying, no, Flint, we've got kids that are sitting out under our sign out here at Blackstone and Shaw that says one pill can kill, and they're using fentanyl under the sign and flipping off the sign at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, the accidental overdose piece of this, at least in my opinion, you know, was a year ago and beyond. Now, I'm not saying there's no more accidental overdoses, because I think a lot of what happens is that's that casual drug user on a Friday or Saturday night that is went to go buy, you know, maybe an 8-ball of cocaine or something, and they don't have a fentanyl test strip, and they use the cocaine thinking it's cocaine, and they wind up dead. Or it is that kid that, you know, really didn't understand. Yeah, I think that's a Percocet. I'm going to take that.
Yep.
But we cannot hide the fact that kids are using fentanyl intentionally.
Yep.
We had one kid here in town that literally wanted to be the Pablo Escobar of the fentanyl drug trade. And he was damn near there at 18 years of age. Yeah. Scary stuff.
It's super scary stuff. And, you know, again, it's just, you know, when people seek out, look, I did my share of experimenting when I was young too. You know, I did cocaine and dropped some acid, and this was the 80s, right? Smoking weed and all that stuff. And, you know, I didn't fall into addiction until I was in my 40s. So it's kind of funny. I had a break in between. Yeah. I had a family and a career and all those things, right? But, you know, back then, like, we always wanted to seek out the best stuff, right? So it's like, oh man, you know, my friend Tim, he found a guy that could give me an 8-ball, and it's supposed to be really pure, you know? And so we'd go and buy it, right? It's the same thing with fentanyl. Yeah. It's like people that were, you know, experimenting with heroin or maybe popping an oxycodone pill, and they're like, oh man, I heard about this new drug fentanyl, and it's 50 times stronger. Well, let's go try that, because I'm young and I'm invincible and I don't care. Right. And what's funny about that is that kind of mentality translates actually to the street for people that are experiencing homelessness, but in a much, much sadder kind of way. Mm-hmm. So when I was homeless on the street in 2018, no, I didn't want to die, but I didn't care if I did.
Didn't care, right?
Yeah, I didn't care. So, and I'd given up all hope, and that's kind of how it translates, right? So it's like you just kind of give up, and you're like, screw it. If I die, I die. I don't want to die, but if I die, I die. But I got to have this, because my addiction is telling me that I've got to have this. And those poor kids that are out there under that sign using fentanyl right now, they're hooked. Yeah. And if they're not hooked, they will be. And once they're hooked, that's it. You can't function on fentanyl. You can't be a functioning addict on fentanyl.
Right.
Like, even when I was, you know, when I was using oxycodone, when I was buying pills off the street, and I was using 560 milligrams of oxycodone a day, believe it or not, I could still kind of function. But once I switched over to heroin and fentanyl, I couldn't function anymore and I lost everything.
Right.
So all those other drugs prior have been cut out. It's like fentanyl cut out the middleman.
Yeah.
Just straight to the hard stuff now, right?
Right.
Now they're using this fent and that's it. You're done. And before you know it, you will be on the street or you will be dead.
Oh, yeah. And there's no question, you know, because I was going to ask you this, you know, there were times when I prayed for death, you know, because I was taking the last two and a half years of my use, and I was taking between 70 and 80 Vicodin every day. You know, and of course, in those days, it was so easy to doctor shop. You know, I had 13 different offices going at one time. But you're right. I didn't care if I died. Didn't want to, you know, had a family and all that sort of stuff. But I'd pray for it.
Yeah.
You know, people don't and that's the other part of it, that these people don't understand what the addict is going through. And I'm not saying we need every break in the world here. Okay. But it's going to take some time for people to come back from all of this stuff.
It is. And it's going to take look, the way I say it is there's a subset of people on the street that require intervention. So law enforcement's going to have to play a role. There's going to be some folks that are going to have to be placed in a controlled environment in order to detox and start their journey into recovery. And the thing that's really frustrating for me is that the harm reduction folks talk about this need for safe injection sites everywhere. It's going to save lives. It's going to save lives. And regardless of how you feel about that, my position on that is that, so they think that that's going to save lives. And then you go look at a city like Vancouver, which has 13 safe injection sites, and they just broke their records for overdose deaths in Vancouver. So it's clearly not saving lives. That's bullshit. It's not.
Right.
We have to do is we have to have interdiction, which means the cops have to go out there, the DEA has to go out there, the U.S. Marshals have to go out there, and we have to make it harder to get high, and at the same time, we have to make it easier to get treatment. That's not a new idea, okay?
Yeah,
but it's an idea that we threw out with the baby. We threw the baby out with the bathwater. We threw it all out, and we replaced it with just use safely. You know, in 2020, the Department of Public Health in San Francisco ran an ad campaign called No Overdose, K-N-O-W Overdose. And it had images of like these homeless dudes sitting on a street, sticking a needle in their arm, smiling. Like it was fun.
Right.
And what's funny is I knew some of the people in those pictures because I used to hang out with them on the street. One of those guys is in prison right now for murder. Right. and one of the other people in the picture was a well-known drug dealer on the street. So I'm like, they didn't even do their homework and they wasted $2 million.
Sure. Yeah. Of course.
On this ridiculous campaign. Right. And, you know, through our advocacy, we got all those ads taken down and they admitted that they made a mistake. Right. Because that's the message. And that's the message our government, our public health department is sending to people.
Yeah,
with friends. Don't use alone. But it's okay. I'm homeless, but I'm shooting my van. It's all good.
Right.
Yeah.
Tell him that one. Tell him that one because he's going to die.
I forget who it was, but it was
DanceSafe.org.
Yeah, it was. Try smoking it instead of snorting or injecting.
Yeah.
It's like, are you
boofing? You want to boof it? We'll show you how to boof it, bro.
Yeah.
You know what that is, right? doing it up your butt. So come on.
Right. Yeah. It's like, hey, look, I don't want anyone to get hepatitis or HIV either.
Sure.
But I'd also prefer that they don't die. And let alone when you're talking about these safe injection sites. Oh, by the way, when are they open?
Yeah, 8 to 5. What, is the addict going to use that, not use after 5 and not before 8 a.m.?
The mistake they're making is that they glamorize the whole damn thing and they're normalizing it too. And this is a problem that we have in this country. The United States has a love affair with drugs.
Yeah,
no question about it. We've been glamorizing drugs since the 80s. I remember listening to Motley Crue in the 80s talking about cocaine and all that stuff. Right? You know, so it's not like, you know, Miami Vice, right? All the cocaine, all the cartels and all that. So it's been glamorized, right? Yeah. And you listen to a lot of music today. They still talk about using drugs, but I'm starting to notice more and more artists talking about getting sober.
Yeah, there's a lot of them out there now.
Right, a lot of them out there. And so, you know, it's like we have to learn things the hard way in this country for whatever reason. And what's sad is that with fentanyl is it's not giving us time to learn. It's just killing us.
Correct.
They just released updated numbers for the last 12 months in the United States. 110,000 people died of drug overdose in the U.S.
Right.
To give you some perspective, in 2013, 10 years ago, It was 17,000 people.
Right.
Yeah. So we've lost almost, it's almost grown by a factor of 10.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And we're sitting here screwing around with our drug policy, and our national drug policy is a decade behind. They're still screwing around with pills. Right. They haven't even gotten to dealing with the fentanyl yet.
Right.
And then we got these radical harm reductionists on the left that are trying to legalize it and trying to bring a safe supply, which there's no such thing, the fentanyl, unless right. you're in a hospital under medical supervision because you had to have open heart surgery.
Right.
There's no such thing as safe supply of fentanyl. That's a lie.
That's a lie. Yeah.
And they're trying to give us safe injection sites, but they don't want to pay for any treatment. Right. It doesn't make any sense to me. I'm sorry. It doesn't.
Glenn, I just love that, you know, with Tom, we can have an amazing discussion. There's so much logic behind everything, but really at the end of the day, much like yourself, me, Tom just wants people to have the opportunity at real recovery.
There it is. There it is. We can get past, you know, we can get past just damn near anything, right? But you're right. But at the end of the day, when it all said and done, we just want people to have that opportunity. And my opinion, we as a society, we are not giving them the correct opportunity to get that done. You know, if you keep telling somebody like society is, whether it's subconsciously, whatever, that you can't do it, well, shit, you're going to keep thinking you can't do it. But so instead of giving them the you can't do it, let's give them the you can do it.
Yeah. I mean, it's as simple as I recall teaching my kids how to ride their bike and falling over, falling off, and like, right. Hey, no, come on, we're going to get back up again and keep going.
Right.
If I just said, oh, forget it and went inside, I mean, come on.
Right. Right.
That dejection is real.
It is real, you know, because the addict is and again, this is not an excuse for people that are listening, but the addict is frightened. Mm-hmm. Okay, we are afraid of stopping for a variety of reasons, and they're all legitimate. Okay. You know, it's not because you know we're chicken shit, so to speak, right? Yeah. I mean, there's just a variety of reasons. So we have to give the person that opportunity to at least attempt sobriety, to attempt abstinence at this, and if they choose not to. You know, at some point, then really there's not much anybody can do about that one. Yeah. But I just would venture to say that the more opportunities we give to people, I would bet a lot of money, all right, that there's going to be more successes than we think.
Absolutely. Especially if we're doing it, we're allowed to do it in the right way.
You bet.
Through the detox process, residential, intensive outpatient, if it's sober living too, is that next transitional step, whatever it is, the more we can get people that opportunity to at least try this on. It's like, you know, we're not used car salesmen, like try it on for 90 days. You don't like it, bring it back. Like,
right.
No, this is an opportunity at a totally different way of life.
You bet it is.
I mean, you've seen it longer than I, but boy, I'm seeing it all the time of you know, for some of the meetings I go, you know, newcomers that are starting to get their color back after 30 days, their eyes are brightening up, collecting a chip for 1 year. And, you know, it's a beautiful way of life.
It is.
That we want to give it away.
Right. Right. We want to give it away. And we're here to give it away. Yeah. So, you know what? Let's keep giving it away.
Absolutely. Well, your closing thoughts for 2023, Mr. Anderson?
Well, glad it's over. And 2023 was a pretty good year. I mean, again, you know, for all intent and purposes, we had some major successes this year.
Yes, sir.
With a lot of different things. The organization's doing fine. We're doing fine. We're above ground. And we keep pushing our message. But 2024, as far as the big change, we have to be better at what we're doing. We have to be better than we have in order to get an effect change somewhere. We're going to have to go, and again, excuse the term, but go after organizations, people, whatever the case may be, in order to not only get our message across, but to affect that change. And we can't be afraid to go after somebody like that or go after certain organizations.
Absolutely.
Because again, in my opinion, there's a lot of these places that are not doing justice to this issue. It's more of a job to them than it is a passion.
Right.
And I'll tell you what, it's time that we kind of put the halt on some of this stuff. So.
Absolutely agreed. It's incredibly disheartening.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you or someone is in need, please don't hesitate to reach out to us here at Payne. That information is in the podcast description. We do everything from, as we mentioned earlier, the Wednesday night group meetings, support meetings.
We've got grief groups.
We've got the Narcan training. We also, of course, Mr. Anderson here does come out and speak at different organizations. You can inquire on that and getting him out this year. Maybe a few your organization will want to be further educated on the crisis that is ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
Reach on out
because we do a lot of stuff.
That's right. Well, thank you all for tuning in 2023. We got some exciting episodes coming your way in 2024. We're going to talk with a couple of individuals that are in that transitional living, that sober living, their experiences, and lots of other highlights. Flint and I will always hop in on topics that, I don't know, piss us off or that we feel needs some relevance for the listener to give a little more education. So thank you all very much for listening to Payne's Don't Hide the Scars podcast. If you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, please call Payne, Parents and Addicts in Need at 559-579-1551 or visit us online at paynonprofit.org. Follow us on social media on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Payne Nonprofit. And please subscribe to the Don't Hide the Scars podcast and share with others wherever you get podcasts and on YouTube. And if you would like to donate to Payne, Parents and Addicts in Need, please click the link in the description to make your tax-deductible donation today and help us save more lives gripped by addiction.